A different start to the programme today. It's a gripping story of the ups and downs of life, the life of a local man and well-known former boxer, Eamon McGee. It's part of the biggest book club in the country, which we do in conjunction with Libraries NI. You can get a copy of the books we feature at your local library, and they also have audiobooks available. This is the story of an Ardoyne boxer who throughout his life has battled drug and alcohol abuse, gambling addiction, imprisonment, prosecution, and was left to pick up the pieces after his son was murdered in 2015. The book is called The Lost Soul of Eamon McGee, and just a heads up, this interview does contain graphic descriptions of what Eamon has been through.
There's two ways of doing it. It was a type of society we grew up in, and again, I wouldn't change a thing. I've enjoyed my wee life, and there's always been some hard times versus some good times, but so I wouldn't change a thing.
So, you were drinking by the age of nine. How hard were you drinking? What were you drinking?
Well, the first time I drank was with my father, to be honest, at Christmas time. Christmas Eve, when we were drinking Monday's wine. Couldn't get my head off the pillow. Christmas Day, me and my father missed our Christmas dinner that day. We were too hungover.
And how old were you?
I was about nine or so.
So you slept through Christmas Day because you had so much to drink with your dad?
Yes.
What was that about?
Yeah, I suppose it was all part of growing up. I don't know, my dad was on the run. I think he was on the run still then. But that was all part of growing up.
And did you drink much as a youngster?
Just concerning that night, I probably had a glass or two of wine or something. It knocked me for 6 steps for real. I should have drunk 10 bottles of it, but
sure.
I was only a kid. But it just materialised. The drinking just materialised from there on in.
I'm trying to get a sense, really, of what your childhood was like. So your dad wasn't around very much, is that fair?
No, well, he was interned. And then he was on the run. And he was in jail. So, well, he was around as much as he possibly could, yeah, to be honest, in those days.
And as a young boy, when the other kids in school had a dad, and, you know, had a mum and dad, maybe some of them, were you jealous of not having a father figure in the house, or what?
When my father was on the run, he was in the house and people didn't know. He was in the house and people used to, I don't know how many rows and fights that I had in school with people plagued me. Eamon, no dad, your dad's dead. Your dad's dead. People didn't realise that I was coming home to my dad every f***ing day. So it was just mainly hid in the house for a long, long time.
What was he on the run for, Eamon?
To be honest, I think it's for bouncing check. My dad would have employed. He was a bricklayer, but he would have employed people. Say it was a two-man job and a labourer's job. My dad would have employed five people, three labourers, for no reason. He was always good at employing people, and then he would have got himself in trouble of trying to raise the wages.
Were you an unruly child when you were growing up, or did you get into much trouble growing up as a young teenager, for example?
No, I was never in trouble in my life, but that doesn't mean that I didn't anticipate things that was going on in the district and that, but no, I wasn't a bad kid. I was well-mannered. It was just a city we grew up in, and then if you weren't involved with it, you thought you were missing something, you know, but didn't know anything different in those days.
At what point did you realise that Northern Ireland was a really difficult place for you to grow up in? When did it click with you?
Probably when I was about 9 or 10. I walked into the gym when I was seven, and I was around about the ages of 8 and 9 as we were heading home, all the ratting was going on. And you just anticipated that, thought you were missing something. We didn't know anything different in those days. You weren't taught anything different.
Did you do much ratting?
Yes. Our dogs, I mean, it's 4 ways in, 4 ways out, and we had to protect ourselves.
What would you have done, Eamon? As a child?
Well, if the district needed closed off, we would have closed the district off. You know what I mean? There would have been 4 vehicles. hijacked, and the Fagles was always commercial Fagles. You never took anybody's private property or anything. And when the Fagles took off them, you made sure they took all their belongings with them. They were, nobody got hurt, nobody didn't have them. It was always a firm's fun. They'd always get hijacked. It was never nobody's personal belongings.
And you took some comfort in that? It was a decent hijacking, was it, in your head?
Yes, well, it was decent hijacking. Nobody get hurt. That was a golden rule. Nobody has to get hurt. We're not there to hurt people. They were just here to close the area off.
But, of course, looking back on it now as an adult, looking back on it, you probably realise that you can't have a decent hijacking. Pretty traumatic for the person getting hijacked and you know, financial loss to the company.
Yeah, but we always made sure to reinsure them, made them feel as more comfortable as anything at all. And 9 out of 10 of them get out of the car and says, "Okay, lads, thank you, here you go." And away they went on their peaceful mind.
So how old would you have been when you participated, for example, in the first hijacking?
12, 13.
And how does a 12 or 13-year-old intimidate an adult to get out of a car, get out of a vehicle?
Remember, you don't do it on your own.
The world of most 12 and 13-year-olds is going to the Cubs or going to the Boy Scouts or going out and playing football or doing whatever. So I'm just trying to picture the scene.
We didn't have no Cubs or Boy Scouts or anything to get round about in Ardoyne. We were growing up. There was nothing in Ardoyne for us.
Did you get a sense of hopelessness out of that? Or?
Well, I got a sense that if nobody gives a shit about you. The whole nation, nobody gives a shit about if you're in Ardoyne. AFUs. Ardoyne hasn't have moved on then in the last couple of generations.
You basically felt like nobody cared about you. Is that fair?
Yes. Yes. We thought that in them days we were doing the right thing of attacking our district. Yeah. We thought we were doing the right thing.
Sure. Do you feel any sense of guilt about that now?
No, not really, because as I'm saying, Stephen, we were protecting our area. And we still would do it again if we had to.
What do you think of the British?
Well, they didn't fade the end of Ireland, didn't they? You know, if you read the book, you can see how many troops were landing on such a date, and how many tens of thousands of troops were landing on another such a date, another tens of thousands landing on another such a date. For what reason? It's in the Ireland. We're one country.
And do you accept that the point we're at now, we can all go over the past, and you know, part of living in Northern Ireland is people have all different perspectives on what happened in terms of the past. Do you accept now, Eamon, that we've got relative peace, and basically what the Good Friday Agreement is saying is that Northern Ireland should remain in the UK until the majority vote otherwise? Do you think that's a decent deal? Are you happy with that?
Sure, we're happy until the majority votes. But it's the same way. We did vote as the North of Ireland to stay in the European Union. But no, that was taken away from us. The same as Scotland voted to stay in the European Union, because only the people out of London, which where most of the votes came from, and in Wales, Cardiff, blah, 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 they're making decisions up for the Scottish and making decisions up for the North of Ireland.
Yeah, because
I think that's slightly ridiculous.
As that young, angry boy protecting your area, okay, now that you're an adult and you've been through all that life experience, do you have many British friends? Unionist friends? And
I have more Protestant friends than I have Roman Catholic friends.
Yeah.
Trust me. I can walk across the shingle, I can walk up and down the shingle, and people stops and gives me lifts and give me a lift home over the Ardoyne. I lived in Ballyclare for a couple of years. I was at the bonfires. We were getting free drink. We were getting free burgers. I have more Protestant friends than I have Catholic friends at the minute.
That was the purpose of my question. All of that anger that you had as a young man towards the British, that did not translate into being angry towards your unionist friends.
No, most definitely not. Yeah. No. It was only for British troops to get them out there and which they're not here now, are they? Well, now we've got the new PSNA. They do say there's 49% of them are Roman Catholics now. We didn't have that when we were growing up. We had 2% of them being Catholics when we were growing up. They were very bitter.
We could talk all day. You've had an interesting life, haven't you? There have been lots of twists and turns. At what point did you realise you had a drink problem?
Probably when I fought for the Ulster junior titles, I think it was, into George and Malagis. It was either youth or junior title. So that means it was either 15, 16 or 17 years of age. And I went into the finals into George and Malagis in the Margates. And I was drunk as a skunk. I was in the GA club that morning at 6:30. Because it was out the night beforehand and I was hungover. So my dad always says the best thing to do is have an hour drink the next day. So I took as a feast, put on the drink, and I ended up very, very drunk, fighting in the Ulster finals, which is still on to win.
And what's it like fighting drunk?
Well, you'd be slightly unstable, but in my eyes, it was just another day's work. You have to turn up.
Part of fighting at your level, it's not just about pure strength, is it? It's about technique. And it's about perfecting a technique.
Never even thought of boxing as in a strength. Boxing's an art. I always treat it as like a game of chess. I'm always 2 moves ahead of you. I know what you're going to do even before you know what you're going to do.
Like what? Explain that to me.
Very art.
Explain
that to me.
You
might want to walk you around the left, and once you walk around the right, I'm watching your feet, your legs cross, so I can walk you back around the left, and walk you back around the right. I can show you the left hand, hit you with the right, and show you the uppercut, I'll hit you with the hook. It's just all these things that put you off. I've got to keep your mind working, even blinking, moving. Do you know, I need your eyeballs working all over the place so your mind's not set, nice and settled. I mean, I'm in control.
But how do you do all of that drunk?
When you're nearly 4 years staying the way I am, you'll soon know. I was undefeated for 10 years. I won 11 national titles, 11 Antrim titles, 11 Ulster titles, 11 intermediate titles. I travelled the world representing Ireland undefeated. The first time I smelt defeat in over 10 years was in the World Championship Finals in Puerto Rico, 1989. It's only the second Irish man ever to win a world silver medal. Five fights in 1 week at World Championship level. I mean, that's unheard of. It was the very first time I was beaten over 10 years. And then when I got back, I still continued on winning. It took another lot of years before I could beat. Seemed to know what I was doing.
Oh, listen, and I'm not questioning that, right? It's obvious. Of course you did. You were born with a talent, right? A huge talent. I guess what I'm trying to say to you, Eamon, is it would be pretty natural. You must have thought at some stage, if I was that good drunk, how good would I have been sober?
No, of course. I've asked myself that question many a time. Sure, I mean, if it had a penny for every person to come up to me and ask me that same question, even on the street or in a bar, I'd be a millionaire. I mean, at the end of the day, with no alcoholism or drugs or anything related, I should have been a multi millionaire.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I should have been fighting the next Floyd Mayweather and Peck, yeah, and stuff. I mean, they were already lined up until my accident happened.
Is this the one about your legs being clubbed?
Yes.
What happened?
My daughter knocked down the snowman, and I was down there. We had a fight outside his house, and then I got in a car. And then they blocked me in, got out and attacked me with pickaxe handles.
And they beat your legs?
Yes, he left part of my leg in the street. I never got it. So I had to go through a flap operation. That means they took a muscle from the back of my leg, flapped it round to the front, and then skin graft from my thigh, and put it over the top of it.
When you say he left part of your leg in the street and you never got it, what do you mean?
I mean, he left part of my leg in the street with the flesh. If you have a look at my leg, you'll realise of how much of it I've lost. Where the things they do these days are amazing in hospital. Beat me out hard. I mean, I could look right down into my bone. Near enough, I mean, I could put my whole hand in the wound and just see my bone. All the skin, there was nothing there. There was no muscle there, no nothing. So they took my muscle from the back of my leg and put it around the end of the front.
And you're telling me this was all off over your daughter knocking down a snowman?
Yes. This is the same way I stabbed in the neck because I hadn't got a cigarette. And when I came home from after winning the World Silver Medal again back to Puerto Rico, I was only home a week, standing last in the Pizza Hut on the Antrim Road, say the Phoenix Bar. And Jay asked me for a cigarette. He says, I haven't got one, mate. So I come out and I walk down the alleyway beside the Phoenix. Something walking down my neck. Hey, holy what's that? Paper hat was bleeding. I was able to stick my whole four fingers in the hole, right down as far as my knuckles, to stop the bleeding. And thank God when I came out of the alleyway, what was sitting in the traffic lights, an ambulance. And we were able to get the ambulance, and they just U-turned, brought me straight to the matter. And it's only, it's less than a quarter of an inch away from a juggler. So there's one lucky guy at night over a cigarette.
Do these things traumatise you to the point where you get flashbacks and you're having nightmares?
It did. But there's one thing, exactly what we're doing now, there's one thing I have learned over the, I suppose, it's years of experience. It's nice to talk about it, even though I'm talking to you now about it. It's nice to have the things that get off your chest.
Yeah.
Where there is people that can't do that there, and they build it up and build it up, and God knows what happened to them.
Absolutely.
It's nice to talk about it. And,
so that's what I'm, that's why I'm, yeah, and that's why I'm asking you. You know, you're a hard man, right? There's no doubt about that. You're a tough guy, both professionally and clearly in how you live your personal life. You're tough. You're a hard man. But when someone, you know, leaves some of your leg in the street, when someone stabs you in the neck and it's knuckle deep, what's it like when you're then lying in bed at night and you're thinking about that and you're maybe getting nightmares, you're getting flashbacks? How bad did they get, Eamon?
Well, as I would say, at the very start, you would have been getting that there, but as the years go on...
And what you would have been getting what? Can you describe what happened to you?
Let me finish. Yeah. When you're in a bed, just like to say the first year or two after the accident that happened, certainly you're getting your flashbacks as if it's just happened last night. There's even times that you might even feel the pain still again. But as the old saying goes, times are here. And I won't let it keep me down. I'm a better man than that to let anything they had to keep me down. My old saying is, your chin up and your arse out and lead on. Nobody else is going to do it for you in this world. You have to look after number one, and that's you.
Did it get you down?
It did, surely. I'm on antidepressants. I'm on the Azipan. You know, that's the law against me, but just don't let it beat me. I'm a better man than that.
Have you beaten alcoholism, or are you still drinking, Eamon?
No, I'm still drinking.
You drinking today?
I'm having a drink now as I'm speaking to you.
I could hear it. And we're recording this at...
5 o'clock in the a.m.
Aye. So how much of a grip has it still got on you?
One of the main reasons why I like my alcoholism at the minute is just to boredom. I live on my own. I'm not going to sit in a house and look at four walls. I always try to keep myself busy so that I don't. But if I've nothing to do today, I'm hanging on a drink.
What you said there, I'm not sure if you meant it, right? When you said one of the reasons why I like my alcoholism. So alcoholism is a disease that's, it's not good for you, right? You know that.
Yes.
So you don't really like it, do you? You didn't mean that.
No, I don't really tell you. It's done through boredom.
You've said you're going to talk openly to me this morning, and thank you for doing so. Are you lonely?
I am. Yes, see, I'm a mum, young. You know, my kids are all growing up now. They have their own lives to live. Yes, I do see them. Yes, I do talk to them. But they're not around me all the time.
And do you mind? Because
I
do think it'll help other people, because loneliness is a big thing, right?
Never doubt a doubt.
Can you talk to me about that? Open up to me about that? What's it feel like from your perspective?
Well, the main thing is completely boredom. Sitting looking at four walls, you're sitting, you know what's coming on next thing before it comes on, next thing the TV, and you're always thinking, if I could go down to a bar, sure, social club, you see. So I could make it down a bar. And then you do feel comfortable when you go down to a bar, you're talking away to people, you're having a good laugh. Where if you're sitting up in the house, you're sitting scratching the head of yourself, bored. But if you go out to the bar, you can socialise with people and have a good chat.
Yeah. It's interesting that the title of your book is called The Lost Soul.
Yes.
Why was that title chosen? Is that how you feel about yourself? A lost soul?
No, that's how my mother felt about herself. It was one question that he asked Paul Gibson, which is the editor, the writer. I asked Paul, how'd you come up with that? He says, it's just a wee statement that your mother came off with when she was interviewing my mother, and I would let him. When I was interviewing my mother, I just leave them because I had the feeling be on their own so they can talk without me being there. Mm-hmm. And my mother just says, I am just like a lost soul. And he just, that's where it came from.
And did you feel like a lost soul?
I did at times, growing up in this district, now without a doubt.
Lost in what way?
The only thing you had to do in this district was either rat or go on the drink. Or people were on the glue. Drugs weren't out then. You had very little to choose from in this district, yeah.
Do you have much money? I'm asking that question in the context of, because of your talent, you earned hundreds of thousands of pounds over the years.
I remember I'm on the social. I'm on the cigarette. So, okay. Very little money.
So you know the question I'm going to ask, where did it all go? Is it true that you earned hundreds of thousands of pounds?
Well, the bookies took it all anyway, whatever I earned.
What'd you gamble, the horses or what?
Yeah, anything. Two spiders going up a wall. I'm a gambling anything.
We've talked about your alcohol addiction. Do you have a gambling addiction?
I'm off gambling now. Over a year, and believe it or not, I'm sick of telling people. It's been the happiest year of my life so far from I've stopped gambling. I'm able to wake up in the morning and put my hands and money as and when I wanted to. Go and get my food as and when I wanted to. Go and get a beer as and when I wanted to. When I was gambling, I wasn't able to do all that there. I haven't been walking about this last year, 2018, with the happiest smile on my face for my style of gambling. And I'm getting a better buzz out of that there than if it had won big.
What was your biggest win?
God knows.
Did you have any really big wins?
I did, Yeah. But sure, they weren't too long going back. You're just giving me flashbacks on it. It wasn't too long. You weren't too long giving a hand back then. They're only lending you money.
What would a big win be? Like, what's big in your... What was big in your world?
It was tens of thousands.
Wow. That's big. It was reported that you were staking at one stage £20,000 on a match.
Well, the biggest one that I've done was 40.
1,000?
Yes.
Did you win?
It was the All Ireland final, and my team was a mile in front the first half. The other team was coming back, and the final whistle blew. The guy kicked the ball, and it was in mid-flight. And the game was over, but the ball was in mid-flight, so I mean, they still didn't play. And a bit over the bars, and it ended up a draw.
So you lost your 40 grand?
I did.
Can you describe the feeling when you lose that amount of money?
It's absolutely disgusting. So what do you think you would do or call yourself? Then I was young and foolish. Now we're older and wiser.
And again, I asked you to reflect, and thank you for being so open today. I asked you to reflect on, you know, the alcoholism. Have you ever in your personal moments added up how much you think you've lost through gambling?
I don't even mind. Sometimes I don't even want to think about it.
Like, would it be hundreds of thousands? Or?
I just don't even want to think about it.
Okay. Do you still try to keep yourself fit?
I do. I'm in the gym every day.
Every day?
Yes, well, Monday to Friday.
So can I ask you, like, for example, today, right? So yes. You've had a few drinks this morning.
Yes.
Will you go to the gym then?
Yes, it will, surely. I get there every day and have done for years. The alcoholism in my eyes, I mean, I get all fluttered and messed up and don't know what to do if I'm not drinking. Where if I have a couple of beers during the day, that's me settled and I can concentrate on my day and lead on in life.
But what about getting help, Eamon, for your alcoholism?
Well, I tried that too, but it didn't work.
What about trying again?
I tried about 6 or 7 times.
It's going to end up killing you. You do know that.
We're only on this planet for a short time. So the only thing, the bookies won't take a bet off you. You can't walk into the bookies and say, I'll have £1 million on myself to die one day.
Yeah, but come on. What age are you, 47?
Yes.
Right. So if you're drinking in the morning like you are today, you're going to kill yourself. You know that. And there's a contradiction, and you're smart enough to know this. There's a contradiction in doing that damage to your body and then going to the gym and working hard to improve your body and taking pride in your body.
Yeah, but when I'm in the gym and I'm sweating, I'm taking all the badness out of my body. I'm not. When my pores open, all the badness is floating in out. That's why I always understand it as it is.
My goodness, I'm sure people will be very interested in your book, The Lost Soul of Eamon McGee. You know, we've talked about a lot of painful moments in your life, Eamon. Losing a child is the most painful thing to happen to any parent.
Especially under them circumstances.
Yeah. And you lost your child.
Of all things, over a woman. I says they on the Turk.
This was your son, Eamon Jr., and he died in May 2015.
Yes.
How close were you?
I was my blue eyed boy. I was my son. He was the Bobby of the family. He went everywhere with me. Loved his daddy. Tried to look after his daddy every time. And all he used to have some laughs with him. He was a good kid. Very good. He's absolutely a tremendous, durable child. I'm not saying it because he's been murdered or bad, but he was. And nobody has a bad word ever to say about him. He was such a lovely child. And just because he was out with a lady friend, he had to lose his life over it.
And your son Eamon was very much following in your footsteps, wasn't he? He was an up-and-coming boxer.
He was a cracking boxer. Again, Eamon, he boxed southpaw. Which, like myself, that means you're left-handed. But Eamon was right-handed, so he should have been boxing other ducks. No, but he chose to box southpaw, because it's the same as his daddy. And I mean, if you watch, he only had the two professional fights. And if you watch the professional fights, you would think it was me in the ring again. He was so cute, just moving about, not missing anything, using his head. He was very good at what he'd done. He could have gone a long, long way, bless him.
And would you have taught him boxing techniques? Would you have spent time with him training?
Yeah, well, Eamon and I used to done me any of my kids. I never took him to the gym once in my life. They have to figure out, see, the boxing, it's a job, but you have to figure out yourself where if you want to do it or not. You don't want to be forced into it. They want to be the parent that has, kid, you have to go to the gym, you have to go to the gym. If you want to go to the gym, you go to the gym. But it says, when you turn professional, then it's a business side. Then you'll come to me, and I'll work with you. When he turned pro, yeah, he came along with me, and he was improving every time. Every day was a good day.
And can you remember the moment you heard you'd lost your son?
I do. I was in the kitchen. I was drunk. I was on drugs. And I got a phone call. And it was my ex, Eamon's mother, Mary Doll. She was phoning me, so I didn't even answer. Why she was phoning me at 2:30 in the morning for, so I didn't really want to answer. Then Ethan's mother, she phoned me on her phone, so I sort of became, there's something wrong here. So I answered her phone, and I just got the news. He was dead. Within the matter of minutes, it was over. But I suppose when it was over, you were only more or less going over to identify the body.
I don't know what to say, you know. I don't know what to say about, I'm sorry you've lost your son. I don't know how to, the pain must just be a different type of pain than you experience in any other circumstance.
It's not so much of that there. It's about the Turk put his for 2 years. He was pleading not guilty, making us go to courts so many times. And then when we started making jury swearing, with everything all ready to up and run, the first day or two, the thing starts. See, once you learn of what he done to my son, when Eamon came out of the house, obviously he's walking forward. He came from behind and hit him 2 strikes in the thigh. That's obviously to bring your prey down. And when he brings the prey down, he hit him first 2 strikes was in the lungs. That was the only good thing about his death, because it meant he wouldn't bleed out within seconds. He wouldn't have a few pain. But after he hit him, the two strikes in the lungs, he hit him another couple of strikes. So, you mean, you can see that it was pre-planned, premeditated. He was sitting down waiting on his prey coming out. And when he took him out, I mean, what I can't believe is what Judge Tracy done on my Amos killer. He gave him 14 so-and-so years. Said, how are they? That doesn't make sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense to you, but obviously the judge will be following the guidelines that he's given and working within the sentencing guidelines.
I mean, I know they gave him the guidelines because I ain't stupid. See, the ring and says to you, by the way, he was sitting waiting on his prey, but he should have been judged or prosecuted it as a hitman. And the hitman tariff starts at 21 years upwards. He gave him 14 years. He should have been classified as a hitman. That's exactly what hitmen do.
And Eamon Jr.'s life was taken. He was just 22.
Only 22. Poor Bobby. He's only starting out in his life. A beautiful life.
Yeah.
He was gone within seconds.
And do you think your drinking, Eamon, is to dull some of the pain of losing a child?
Most definitely.
Do you think that maybe some professional counselling might help you with that? Have you tried to get help for that?
To be honest, no, because I'm a great believer. I'll deal with it. See, when I'm speaking to you, we're on the radio station here at the minute.
Yes.
It's exactly what I'm going to say to him. But what answers am I going to get at him? You know what I mean? What's he going to tell me? Is he with this? Is he with it? You need to go through. You need to talk to somebody who is with through things like this here. They're the better people to talk to you instead of people that haven't got a clue, don't know their feelings.
Well, here's
and
all.
And they come up with these answers.
Well, here's all I'm saying to you, all right? And we don't know each other. You've heard my voice on the radio, okay? I know your backstory. You know some of mine. But we don't know each other. But here's all I'm saying to you. You see, when you're saying you'll deal with it, all right?
Yes.
You're not dealing with it in a way that helps you. All right? So drinking in the morning to deal with it, that's not dealing with it in a good way. And these people are professionals, and I reckon you should just try it.
I appreciate your concern.
And you see, if you try it and it doesn't work, then at least you've tried it. I'm telling you, it works for lots of people. But here's what's going to happen. So you say you're lonely. You've been very honest about that. You're lonely. There's lots of what ifs in your life. Your son's been murdered. I don't think there's too many human beings could deal with that on their own. So why don't you reach out and get a bit of help?
You don't know how strong I am.
Well, we're all only strong to a certain extent, Eamon.
Don't be worrying about a thing. I ain't let me take my life if you're thinking anything like that. There.
No, I'm not thinking that. I've been straight up with you. Yeah. Here's what I think just listening to you today. I think if you're drunk or you're slurring your words at 11 o'clock in the morning, I think that you must be doing your liver an awful lot of damage. And I think
you're saying I'm slurring my words at the minute?
A little bit. I could tell you to have a drink.
Well, it's a believe. I've only had one beer. I don't know what one beer will do to me. If I'm certain my words a wee bit, maybe I'm a wee bit sentimental when we're talking about my son there.
Okay. I guess I'm not trying to trick you. Here's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say that, look, if you're drinking every day, if you're drinking in the morning, no doubt you're drinking at night, you're going to kill yourself, Eamon. So get a bit of help. But look, maybe it's none of my business.
No, but maybe you're 100% right. I mean, it's not adventure, not gaining. I'm always up for a challenge anyway. And if it works out better for me, then why not give it a go?
Have you got people that care about you and love you?
They're all my family does.
Okay. Why did you write this book, Eamon?
Why did I write it?
Yeah.
See, now, many opportunities to write the book many moons ago. People were offering me money and all up front and stuff and blah, blah, blah. But they just wanted a boxing book. And I know I don't want the boxing book. So when Paul approached me, I had a meeting with him and I explained, no, Paul, I just don't want it to be a boxing book. I want it to be the story of my life. I guess life needs to be told. I have to take my hat off to the writer. He done a tremendous job on it. He done a real good job. I'm proud of it.
Eamon, thank you so much for talking to me today. And look, it's a very honest conversation.
Yes,
we've had. Eamon, thank you very much indeed, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's part of our book club. The book is called The Lost Soul of Eamon McGee.